There's not an American writer, not Hemingway, not Emily Dickinson, not Faulkner, who is named as required reading by American high school and junior high school students. Shakespeare is.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. This week, we consider William Shakespeare, an American icon, enlisted forever in our political fights.
It is explosive, it is potentially toxic, but that's why it speaks to us.
Plus, how Love Labor's Lost resonated in Kabul, Afghanistan.
These four princes take an oath that they are going to study for the next 4 years and they will not interact with any woman. And that sounded very much like Taliban. And all the actors laughed and said, what? Shakespeare actually came up with this 400 years ago?
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This summer, as the numbers of the vaccinated rise, we get to spend time outside, go to all those favorite places shuttered by COVID-19. Many of us will flock to outdoor festivals, including Shakespeare festivals, where actors once again will be treading the boards. Shakespeare would find all this familiar, according to historian J. Leeds Barrell III, in the four-year period between 1606 and 1610. It's likely the London playhouses were open for all of 9 months, if that, due to plague. Shakespeare, a shareholder in some of those spaces, would have been financially devastated. But he did use the occasions of quarantine to write Anthony and Cleopatra and The Tempest and, according to legend, King Lear. Emma Smith argued in the New York Times that likely he wrote most of his plays amid the threat of infectious disease. Thank goodness it didn't derail him. He is America's national poet, our national dramatist. You know that, right? His words are quoted as routinely as the Bible to mean whatever we want them to mean. James Shapiro is professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. His most recent book is Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Future. Last year, I asked him, who owns Shakespeare?
Everybody stakes a claim in Shakespeare, going back to 1776 and even a few years before then. Those on both sides of the cultural divide, whatever the cultural divide at that moment was, reached out to Shakespeare, enlisted him in their cause.
John Adams said that the history plays were a roadmap to where we were heading, the treachery, perfidy, treason, murder, cruelty, sedition, and rebellions of rival and unbalanced factions.
Could you imagine writing that in a letter to your son, the future sixth president of the United States? But he did. And John Adams was looking around, and he saw an America that was divided, that was factionalized, that was at risk. And he imagined one day, and he even did a riff on Henry V in this imagining, one day we would have a president of the United States put in power by a foreign despot or dictator who had some kind of economic control over him. The divisions that splinter us today have been there from the founding of our republic, as has Shakespeare.
In 1877, a columnist in the New York Herald declared that Shakespeare was an American hero.
You would think that having broken from Britain in 1776 and then went on to fight another war with them, that we would not adopt as our national poet, England's national poet. But in fact, we have. There's not an American writer, not Hemingway, not Emily Dickinson, not Faulkner, who is named as required reading by American high school and junior high school students. Shakespeare is.
Why do you think that is?
We want to believe that what started in England ended in America. We keep wanting to rip or wrest Shakespeare away from the English who don't appreciate him, who don't value him.
How do they make that argument?
We have a lot more Globe theaters or imitation Globe theaters in our country than they do in Britain. We have far more Shakespeare summer festivals here. There's really a determined effort to make Shakespeare fully American, sometimes in really disturbing ways, sometimes in just plain humorous ways.
So let's talk about immigration and race and difference generally, because in Shakespeare's comedies, which are actually any of the plays that have a happy ending, sort of, you note that the marginalized are always the losers.
One of the ways in which Shakespeare has made himself really useful to those who want to weaponize him is through the structure of his comedies. I mean, we all love the way they end in marriage and communal celebration, but that community at the end of all these joyous plays is premised on somebody being kept out. You define yourself by who you don't admit. So whether it's Shylock at the end of The Merchant of Venice, or Jaques in As You Like It, or Caliban, who's not allowed to go back with everybody to Italy at the end of The Tempest, or Malvolio at the end of Twelfth Night. Mm-hmm. You define who's in by determining who's kept out, mocking them, and excluding them. What better way to define who's an American than along this model that is time-tested through Shakespearean comedy?
Pause for a moment at Caliban in The Tempest, this beastly figure who, in a 1916 production, is a stand-in for the unwashed immigrants.
Yeah, those are my grandparents, I suppose, on both sides, living on the Lower East Side, who are called by sociologists of the day kind of Caliban figures. Just look at their faces, look at their shoulders as they go to and from the sweatshops.
Sometimes am I all wound with adders, with cloven tongues to hiss me into madness.
Caliban is, in the late 19th century, increasingly seen as a Darwinian missing link, half man, half beast. And he became a kind of metaphor or stand-in for those who were not fully accepted into white Anglo-Saxon American culture. A very talented playwright named Percy MacKaye wrote this great mask of Caliban, Caliban by the Yellow Sand. And the Caliban figure was supposed to be somebody who was educated successfully into American culture, if you will. Except every 15 or 20 minutes he tries to assault or rape Miranda. He's incorrigible. Even as this was being staged, it undermined its message of acceptance and only underscored that America could not absorb the Calibans of this world.
Now, Othello is no comedy, but he reverberates through history. You recalled that John Quincy Adams, who was well known as an abolitionist, had a surprisingly visceral distaste for Othello.
It's the saddest chapter in my book. Othello is a fundamental American play. Its history here is completely different from its history in England. In England in 1825, an African-American was actually performing the role of Othello on the London stage. But it would be over 100 years before Paul Robeson could do the same on Broadway.
My wife? What wife? I have no wife. Oh, insupportable. Oh, heavy hour. Methinks it should be now a huge eclipse of sun and moon, and that the affrighted globe should yawn at alteration.
The story of John Quincy Adams is the story of my book, which has as its argument, Americans are really not good at talking with each other about things they disagree vehemently about or things they don't want to admit about themselves. John Quincy Adams, as you say, great abolitionist, fought the Amistad case in front of the Supreme Court after he served as America's sixth president, joined the House of Representatives to fight slavery. And yet, he could not wrap his head around the idea of a white woman sleeping with a black guy. Just could not do it. He was invited to what turned out to be the worst dinner party in history. He was seated next to the superstar British actress Fanny Kemble, and he spent the evening mansplaining Shakespeare to her, including saying that Othello was disgusting.
And the person most to blame in the play is Desdemona.
Absolutely. She doesn't respect male authority, and she marries a black guy. And John Quincy Adams says, in getting kind of strangled and smothered to death at the end, she got what she deserved. Mm-hmm. What do you think when one of the great opponents of slavery is actually thinking this stuff? And of course, many people think this stuff, but they don't say it or write it. And after that terrible dinner party, she went home, wrote up her notes, and 2 years later published the conversation. He, mortified, writes this essay on the character of Desdemona, trashing her for falling in love and marrying a black guy. He just couldn't understand why everybody didn't kind of go along and accept his view. And it appeared in major periodicals, and he wrote two essays saying this, in fact. The real shocker was Fanny Kemble wrote a letter that was later published to a friend in which she quotes Adams using the N-word to describe Othello. And I just can't believe it. You want to imagine a kind of more pristine American past. One of the ways of learning what we weren't taught about American history in high school is through how we talk about Shakespeare.
In your chapter on Manifest Destiny, when the nation embarked on exploiting or exterminating non-white people coast to coast, you observed an interesting evolution in the notion of masculinity, one that played out both in that policy and in the productions of Romeo and Juliet.
If you look at the American stage at this time, the model of what a man should be, which is sober and serious, hardworking, is replaced by a blustery, aggressive, heavily sexualized, violent type. The upshot of this was, when it came to casting Romeo, every guy who was trying to play that role failed in it. Because at some points in the play, he has to be, as Shakespeare calls him, effeminate.
Then I defy you, stars!
And at other times, he has to pick up a sword and kill Tybalt and be really kind of masculine. So women began taking over the part. 20 women played Romeo at this time. And the greatest of them was Charlotte Cushman. It tells you something about changing roles of masculinity when only a lesbian can play Romeo successfully in America. The most amazing thing I stumbled on in writing and researching this book was on the eve of the Mexican-American War, when 4,000 American troops are gathered on the border to cross the Rio Grande, and the officers decided to build a theater and put on plays with all-male casts. And one of the first plays they did was Othello. And they couldn't find somebody to play Desdemona.
And then they found this rather slight, pretty young officer.
Who looked great in a dress. Ulysses S. Grant. This is kind of pre-$50 Bill Grizzled Grant. He was girlish in those days. The guy playing Othello couldn't get up enough emotional excitement. They sent to New Orleans for a professional actress to sub for Grant, who went on to bigger and better things. But It was great to think of a future American president playing a woman in love with a black man. I mean, that tells you something about where this country has been.
British portrayals of Shakespeare protagonists, especially Macbeth and Hamlet, were very different from the American portrayals.
Do not muse at me, my most worthy friends. I have a strange infirmity.
True, in part because the lead American actor at this time, a guy named Forrest.
Edwin Forrest.
When they found him finally at the end of his career, dead in bed, they found a pair of hand weights at the foot of his bed. He was one of the early advocates of the pumped-up actor. He was the first great homegrown male Shakespearean actor, and he defined it in opposition to that kind of thoughtful, brooding, reflective English Shakespearean.
Am I a coward? Who calls me villain? Breaks my pater cross, plucks off my beard and blows it in my face, tweaks me by the nose, gives me the lie of the throat as deep as to the lungs. Who does me this?
Macbeth and Hamlet, who we just heard, were portrayed as warriors in America. They even cut the parts where they looked weak out of the plays. And that brings us to Lincoln's assassination.
John Wilkes Booth is notorious as the man who assassinated Lincoln at Ford's Theater in April 1865, but he was also one of the great Shakespeare actors of his day.
John Wilkes Booth played Macbeth, what, about 100 times? But it was the character of Brutus in Julius Caesar that seems to have been the true inspiration for what he did.
He loved the character of Brutus, as many in 19th century America did. This is a man who opposed tyranny, and the South saw Lincoln as a tyrant. Booth only acted once in this play, but he recited the speeches all the time. After assassinating Lincoln, he leaped onto the stage, a little leaping trick he stole from his Macbeth productions, and he shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always with tyrants, playing momentarily the part of an American Brutus right after his assassination of Lincoln.
Talk about the very controversial production of Julius Caesar you were involved in a few years back, put on by the Public Theater in Central Park. It roiled the political right.
Conservative protesters disrupt the controversial performance of Julius Caesar in New York City.
Are you a sad progressive who dreams about President Trump being knifed to death? Well, you're in luck. A new production of Julius Caesar in New York will let you live out your fantasy.
Caesar was dressed like Trump, had certain of his mannerisms, plus a wife, Calpurnia, who sported a Slavic accent. And of course, he's murdered in cold blood. Can you blame the right for being upset?
I don't blame the right for being upset any more than I would blame the left for being upset with, a year or so earlier, Rob Melrose's production of Julius Caesar that had an Obama lookalike assassinated on stage. The tradition of Julius Caesar in this country changed permanently when Orson Welles staged this play in 1937 at the Mercury Theater.
If there be any in this assembly, any dear friend of Caesar's, to him I say that Brutus's love to Caesar was no less than his. If then that friend demand why Brutus rose against Caesar, this is my answer. Not that I loved Caesar less, but that I loved Rome more.
His Caesar was just like Mussolini, and he completely politicized how this play was done. It became a template for how we did Caesar after that. Oscar Eustace, the artistic director of the Public Theater, he wanted to show that saving democracy by undemocratic means, like killing a Trump-like Caesar, was a greater disaster than anything else. I think he wanted to create a sense of whiplash in that liberal audience at the Delacorte Theater. And one of the ways he did that was to have 50 actors hidden throughout the audience so that when Brutus and the conspirators kill the Trump-like Caesar, they're screaming, they're yelling, they're castigating him for doing that, they're calling him out. The problem was when real protesters followed the fake protesters, audience members didn't know where the protests were coming from or who was protesting what. So that invasion, if you will, of the Delacorte by protesters who were paid to disrupt the show ruined the possibility of conversation and dialogue. Or maybe we're just not ready yet for conversation and dialogue in this country.
But Shakespeare does seem to be used like the Bible in the sense that anyone can find a defense for whatever they believe in his text. Do you think his message, his intentions, his morals were more explicit in Elizabethan times and the times they were written?
I don't think so, and I think that's why we still turn to Shakespeare. Shakespeare presents America's worst nightmares, the assassination of a ruler, a black man sleeping with a white woman, a Jew cutting the pound of flesh from a Christian. This is not the stuff in the Bible. And when we stage these things, we're forced to confront the stuff we don't really like confronting as Americans. It's right in our face.
James Shapiro, author of Shakespeare in a Divided America. Coming up, on the relatively lighter side, the bard's use and abuse in American sexual politics. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. There's a fair amount of hanky-panky in Shakespeare's plays, cross-dressing, animal attraction, but very little sex, maybe Romeo and Juliet. There's passionate but platonic same-sex love. In his day, same-sex sex was a capital offense. The sexuality of Shakespeare himself is a matter of speculation. There's plenty of sexual politics in his plays, though. We see women sometimes defending, sometimes demeaning themselves. We see men sometimes punished for their greed or vanity or cruelty, sometimes not. In The Taming of the Shrew, fortune-hunting Petruchio is prone to all three, yet he succeeds in starving and bullying unwilling, ill-tempered Kate into apparent submission. In the musical takeoff, Kiss Me, Kate, two divorced actors find themselves playing Kate and Petruchio, and once again, the rascal has his way, on stage and backstage. James Shapiro is one of our leading bards of the bard, so let's start with the original.
Boy, that's a radioactive story. I mean, it ends with a woman putting her hand beneath her husband's foot.
Great, my reason happy more to bandy word for word and frown for frown. But now I see our lances are but straws. Come and place your hands below your husband's foot, in token of which duty, if he please. My hand is ready. May it do him ease.
Could you describe the evolution of Kiss Me, Kate from Taming of the Shrew?
From 1941 to 45, American women are told, become Rosie the Riveter, enter the workforce, become independent financially and personally.
You observe that at some point, it's really common in film and movies and on stage to depict a woman being spanked. And it changed practically over the course of a few months.
Women are told by the government, get out of the way, become the happy housewife. And if your husband's going to beat you, just grin and bear it. And I'm really not exaggerating. Kiss Me, Kate is written at that moment. And at the center of it is something that was never in Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, being spanked on stage. And spanking a woman is not only domestic violence, but it turns her into a child in a very explicit way.
It was on all the posters.
Oof, and it was in the New York Times when they reviewed it. That's the image from this play that stuck.
Now, there is a warring couple playing the two leads, Kate in Shakespeare's play. She's too much of a shrew for anyone to actually want to marry, so she's auctioned off to this guy passing through named Petruchio. The backstage story seems to follow similarly. At least the woman decides it is the better part of valor to simply bow to her husband's will, wink, wink, nod, nod, or maybe not. You tell a very interesting story about Cole Porter, who found himself with an almost intractable conundrum.
You know, the two great collaborative geniuses behind this musical, one is Bella Spiewak, one of the two women writing Broadway plays at this time, and the other is the great lyricist Cole Porter. This is a hard story to tell. Front stage, you have this restaging of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. Backstage, you have gang members collecting debts, divorce. There are white people, there are black people. It's kind of like real life backstage. And front stage is this artificial Shakespearean world. And they couldn't figure out how to end the play. And they bring out a couple of gangsters to sing a rousing song, Brush Up Your Shakespeare, which people love. And it's the finale of the whole musical as well. And it's a song about basically justifying domestic violence.
If your girl is a Washington Heights dream, treat the kid to a midsummer's night dream. If she fights when her clothes you are mussing, what a clothes much you do about nothing. If she says your behavior is heinous, kick her right in the Coriolanus.
You know, 5 years after this brilliant stage version, Kiss Me, Kate became a movie that was completely sanitizing. All the African-American stuff is removed, and the story in which a woman has real choices is, by the early 1950s, a story in which women no longer have choices.
I trow, and they'll all trow, trow.
So now take us through the strange and perilous journey that was the multiple Oscar-winning film Shakespeare in Love.
And I leave to be if I be not.
Take off your hat.
My hat?
Where'd you learn how to do that?
I...
Let me see you. Take off your hat.
Are you Master Shakespeare?
Wait there. Wait there!
The first script of Shakespeare in Love was written by a screenwriter named Mark Norman. And he, building upon what we know about Shakespeare from the sonnets and much else, imagined a Shakespeare who's married to Anne Hathaway, but who discovers himself falling in love with another man and comes to terms with that. It was way too far ahead of what Hollywood thought Americans were ready for. So they brought in Tom Stoppard, the greatest English playwright, Czech-born, but he's British. Then he gets rid of the gay stuff, and the infamous Harvey Weinstein is the producer trying to bring this thing to the point where it's going to win a gazillion Academy Awards. He's leaning on the director and he's leaning on Stoppard to fix the ending because Americans don't like adultery. And Harvey Weinstein's ideas turn the female lead, the Gwyneth Paltrow character, into a woman you keep on the side and throw parts to in exchange for sex. Or in other words, turn this into the Harvey Weinstein story. And Stoppard luckily resisted that. And the final film version gave Americans just what they wanted.
If I could write at the beauty of her eyes, I was born to look in them and know myself.
And her lips?
Her lips? The early morning rose would wither on the branch if it could feel envy.
And her voice, like lark's song?
Deeper. Softer. None of your twittering larks. I would banish nightingales from her garden before they interrupt her song.
Ah, she sings too.
Constantly.
You also talk about who gets to perform Shakespeare. What does colorblind, genderblind casting mean in the current American context?
To be fully American is to be able to be in a Shakespeare play. And one of the most poignant stories I came across while researching this book was a short story by Toshio Mori, a Japanese-American who was born in the Bay Area and was moved at the beginning of the Second World War, like many Japanese-Americans, to the Topaz relocation camp in Utah. And he writes a story called Japanese Hamlet about a young Japanese man whose only desire in life is to play Hamlet. And nobody can bring themselves to tell him, it ain't going to happen. It's another way of getting at who we really think is fully American.
Is there any one way that Shakespeare's texts can serve as a framework for historical memory?
I think they help us see what has been airbrushed out of the story we like to tell ourselves. And I actually think Shakespeare is a terrific force for good. I speak with a lot of people who are conservatives who love Shakespeare. I speak with a lot of people who are liberals who love Shakespeare. There's not a lot we actually can talk about and share in this country. I like to think that if we are going to do some healing in a post-coronavirus world, theaters as they were for Shakespeare, who lived through an age of plague, they're places where people flock to after trauma, and I'm hoping that they are going to provide some kind of clarity and solace as we put our nation back together again.
It's funny you said, you know, people on the right love Shakespeare and people on the left love Shakespeare, and you'd expect that of something that was blandly, broadly appealing, and yet it's quite the reverse. His body of work is almost combustible.
It is, and that's the great secret of Shakespeare. It is explosive, it is potentially toxic, but that's why it speaks to us. We get it.
Thank you so much.
It is always so much fun speaking with you.
James Shapiro is the author of Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Future. Coming up, a Shakespeare production resonates in Kabul, Afghanistan. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So you've heard about how Shakespeare became a part of the fabric of American culture and identity, but of course, it's not the only nation that's claimed the bard as its own. A 2016 British Council study found that Shakespeare was more popular outside of his home country than within it. And according to a more recent study by the University of Leeds, which analyzed Shakespeare's popularity via Wikipedia articles, readers of certain languages show predilections for certain genres. Russian is number 2 in Shakespeare tragedy page views, but only number 5 in page views of his comedies. And while Albanian, Greek, and Turkish readers show little interest in Shakespeare's poetry, Wikipedia users who read Bulgarian, Catalan, Czech, and Dutch seek it out. Shakespeare's appeal also is felt in Kabul, Afghanistan. Qais Akbar Omar helped launch a production of Love, Labor's Lost there in 2005 during a brief moment when the Taliban had been pushed to the periphery. In this conversation from 2016, he said that it began with the visit of a French actress, Corinne Jabbar, pondering the possibility of a production with some actors. The actors said yes to Shakespeare, but no to tragedy. They lived that for 35 years.
We looked into Midsummer's Night's Dream, but it doesn't coordinate with Afghan culture and customs.
But Love's Labor's Lost did?
It did. Corinne actually came up with that play, but we didn't have access to the translation. So she told the actors, there are 4 princes and 4 princesses, and these 4 princes take an oath that they are going to study for the next 4 years, and they will not interact with any woman, and they will eat one meal a day. And that sounded very much like Taliban. And all the actors laughed and said, what? Shakespeare actually came up with this 400 years ago? And Corinne said, yep. And so what happens next? And she said, well, then four princesses come to the court, try to talk to the king about some serious issues.
So they set up a tent for them.
Exactly, outside, which is again, like nomads always living in Afghanistan in tents everywhere all over the country. So that also has a little bit of connection to the Afghan history and culture. And then they said, what happens? And they said, all these four princes fall in love with these beautiful girls. And then what happened next? And they said, well, let's read the play.
This is one of the notable plays of Shakespeare where there are equal numbers of women and men.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, the women get to make the decision.
That was one of the most important message of the play that we choose this one, because for 6 years, the Taliban did not allow women to work and they were locked inside their houses like prisoners. And in this play, the woman get to make the final decision. It was a great message that no, woman always had an important role in Afghan society, and let's revive that back by this play. Of course, that was happening already, but this play pronounced it a little louder.
And do you think the West has a misconception about that?
They do. They only know of the bloodshed and war, but there is also beautiful other things happening. For example, the love for poetry. We have something called poetry contest. You sit in a circle and I recite two verses from Omar Khayyam and you recite two verses from Rumi.
The great Afghan poet.
Exactly, yeah. The first word of your first verse starts with the last letter of my verse. And
wow.
That goes on for hours. And also, it's not just random poetry. We have to talk about something. Let's talk about love, or let's talk about, I don't know.
So you're talking about alternating verses based on mm-hmm. the last letter, and not mm-hmm. just verses, but verses limited to a particular theme.
Exactly. People don't know these things.
Let's leap from your discussion of the importance of poetry to your problems with getting a translation of Love's Labour's Lost. You had to go to an Iranian translation from a famous poet in Tehran who had translated into Farsi all of Shakespeare's
yes.
plays. I know that Dari, one of mm-hmm. Afghanistan's languages, and Farsi are similar, but
very similar.
They're yeah. not the same. Did you run into a problem there?
Oh, yeah. It was a huge problem. The difference between Dari and Farsi, you know, it's like the difference between old Shakespearean English with a modern-day American English. But we start to read a little more. We got, you know, hang of it. And then we said, oh, wow, this is actually very beautiful. And then by the time we gave the play to the actors, it was amazing. It was more like a poetry contest. Some of the actors, of course, could not read. One of our actresses was a beggar who became famous doing a movie called Osama.
She was a child then. She basically came into a restaurant where the director was begging for money. And he said, I got to put you on film. She was brilliant. But she couldn't read, and she still lived in terrifically poverty-stricken circumstances when you guys tracked her down.
Yes. I mean, she was famous. She made this movie, but she didn't make much money out of it, enough to buy a piece of land, build a few rooms. She never had a chance to actually go to school during the years of Taliban. And the same thing with some of the other actresses.
Although some of those actresses were real dynamos.
Yes. Two of the actresses, one Sabah Sahar, another Birushna Bahar, both of them actually work with the Ministry of Interior as detectives. These are really educated people. They were professional actors. They were, you know, reading it like as if it is their own language, as if, you know, they wrote the play. And one of the actors, his name is Faisal, he believed that Shakespeare was an Afghan who migrated to England 400 years ago, And there he wrote probably one or two plays and he got famous. And he stopped calling himself an Afghan and he became Englishman.
He was convinced of this.
He really believed it. And I said, why do you say that? And he said, Shakespeare writes like Rumi. The only difference is that Rumi's poetry is all about spirituality, God, and all these issues, while Shakespeare writes to entertain people, to make people laugh, and historical issues. But the quality of the language is the same. So how come two people existed, one in Afghanistan, one in England? They must be related. And I said, you make a good point.
But they weren't speaking Shakespeare's words. They'd had to go through several series of translations. I mean, can you, as someone who knew the original so well, say that they were speaking the language of Shakespeare?
You know, Shakespeare, it was very similar to Afghan culture more than any other cultures in the world, because we still live like we were in the 16th century in some parts of the country, and especially with all these rules against women, especially with Taliban just pushed out of the picture, but the memories were still fresh in people's minds. Plus, the quality of the language, when the actors recited their lines written by Shakespeare 400 years ago, it felt very natural.
And the poetry was preserved, you believe?
Yes, very much so, because when you change a word in Shakespeare, the whole thing kind of loses its balance. The whole verse loses its balance, and then you know that something is wrong in here. And it happened a few times in the translation process. One actor or another would say, it doesn't rhyme properly. It doesn't go very well here. Something is wrong. I want to replace it with this word or that word. And then we went and studied both the English and the Dari. And they said, oh, gosh, yes, this word needs to be replaced with this one. It's just amazing. It's like a formula. If you take one number off, everything doesn't make sense.
Marina Golbahari, the very young girl who played Osama in that famous film, could she keep up with this?
Not in the beginning. I had to spend 3 weeks going to the park every day before we start our rehearsals. And I read with her and three actresses. She's an encyclopedia of emotions. And it was just amazing. It just flowed, the whole thing, which is why the first day of the performance, we had enough space for over 500, and there were 250 or 300 people waiting outside, and we just could not let them in. They were mostly men, except for a few foreign women who were diplomats. So these Afghan men, the next night, they came back with their whole families, their sisters, their aunts, their mothers, because they did not see that there was anything un-Islamic. It was just a very, very beautiful play. The third performance we had in Bobber's Garden, we had over 1,000 people for the audience.
Now, this garden you mentioned, a garden that was still undergoing restoration because the Taliban and the Civil War had destroyed it.
Yes.
While that performance was going on, the workers also just stopped and watched.
Yes. They just sat cross-legged on dirt on the floor, smiling. And that was everything for us. After the play, 100 people in their 20s came to me and asked me, who is this guy? Who wrote this? And I said, Shakespeare. And he said, who is Shakespeare? And I said, he's an Englishman. He said, yeah, but that wasn't there. And I said, yeah, we translated it. And he said, wow, can we have the script? So I had my script and I gave it to him. And that script was copied probably 100 times until the lines were unreadable. But at the very last page, I had my phone number and they start calling me and asking for copies.
How many calls?
Oh, quite a few. I had to go and change my number. I just told one of the guys and I said, stop calling me. There is Foundation for Cultural and Civil Society, and I left a few hundred copies there. Then you can make your own photocopies, and that's what happened. And the funny thing is, one of my neighbors one day gave me a copy of it, and I said, hey, have you read this thing? And I said, yeah, I have read this thing. And he said, this is amazing, isn't it? And I said, yeah. You know, Brooke, this is the thing. People don't understand that Afghanistan is so thirsty, and there is so much talent in that country, all waiting for something to happen so that they can just grab that opportunity and move on with their lives. Unfortunately, because of war and Taliban returning back, when the suicide bombers start coming back, you know, in America, you only hear about a suicide bomber killed 12 people in Kabul. But in Kabul, you see the whole thing on TV. They show the blood on the street and the body parts lying from the trees. When you see that, you kind of lose hope for the future. We were planning to take this play all over the country.
The popularity of the show was accompanied by a certain degree of risk. Could you describe that?
Well, the popularity of the show, one thing. Second thing, because it was by an English playwright. Third, it was funded by a foreign organization. Fourth, if the Taliban killed any of us, they would get a lot of publicity out of this. So that's why we just could not risk it.
Was anybody hurt?
One of the actresses, her name is Parveen Mushtail. She is now in Canada with her two teenage daughters and son. Someone knocked on their door. The husband went out to see who was knocking, and he never came back. And the next day, the neighbors found out that her husband was killed, put in a ditch, in a really brutal way. I don't want to talk about the details of that. That actually makes me sad. The woman that earlier we were talking about, Brishna Bahar and Sabah Sahar, who were both
detectives,
yeah. She had to leave her town because people start calling her that she was a whore. And when someone creates that kind of rumor about you, you just have to get out before the crowd kills you. And Sabah Sahar, her family told her to stop making movies. She did not listen because she's a very strong-willed woman and she wanted to do this. So her husband divorced her and took the children away from her because he's afraid that someone probably will kill her, and along the way he would be killed and their children will be killed as well. So I don't know where she is now. She completely disappeared. All the actors went to different directions, and some who are still in Afghanistan are keeping a very, very low profile so that they don't become victim of some stupid people who would get some publicity out of them.
Let's conclude by going over what makes Shakespeare so relevant to the people of Afghanistan.
During the 4 years of civil war, as soon as you walk out of your house, a sniper from the mountain will shoot you. I mean, that was the reality of life until we had ceasefire briefly for a day or two and people ran out of their basements to get some food, and then there was war all over again. And when you're in the basement, all you hear is hundreds of rockets raining all over your neighborhood every day. So I grew up in the basement, and every book we had in the house, I read them probably more than 10 times, including a couple of plays by Shakespeare. So when we decided to do Shakespeare, I was just so excited. You know, when I read Shakespeare with Corinne and the actors, we all felt like, whoa, this man manages to get so much of his feelings out in the open. After they finished reading their monologues, they start talking with each other about what happened to them during the years of civil war or the Taliban. They could relate what Shakespeare was saying in those lines with what happened to them in real life. Sometimes you don't want to talk about the past, but you want to talk about things that happened to you in a kind of opaque but yet poetic way. And that's what was happening among these actors. Sometimes they openly talked about their past. Sometimes they tried to shield it with those beautiful words. We don't have therapy in Afghanistan, and that's, I think, the best therapy they could have through the lines of Shakespeare. And that was more like a, like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like freedom, you know? And then you just feel light.
If you were to produce another play in Afghanistan, what do you think it would be?
I'll choose another comedy. As one of my actors explained it very beautifully, when we do tragedies one day, we will write it ourselves. And we will write it the way it happened. Rockets, bombs, blood, and we'll show all of those things on the stage to the people. So I'll go with something very funny to just make people forget about the past, even if it is for half an hour.
What about All's Well That Ends Well?
That would be nice, except not yet. If we have peace, yes. But I will hold on to that for now.
Qais, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Great talking to you, Brooke.
Qais Akbar Omar is the author of A Night in the Emperor's Garden. As he said, in the end, we each have to tell our own stories. But in the 400 years since Shakespeare's death, it's pretty clear that he set the template for all of our stories, at once unique and universal. Yes, his words are not our words. As Omar said, that's why they give us the gift of a little distance. That is, just before plunging us deep into the impenetrable mystery that is every life. On the Media is produced by Leah Fetter, Micah Loewinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Molly Schwartz, with help from Ellen Lee. Zandra Ellen writes our unique newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.